If you remember one thing today, it should be this. Primary cares is a clear sign that we are changing the status quo. These are sweeping models that will shift one quarter of this country to outcomes-based payment.
I'm Dan Diamond. This is Pulse Check, and that was Adam Bowler, director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, speaking on Monday as the Trump administration unveiled new payment pilots. Bowler and his colleagues, Secretary Alex Azar and Administrator Seema Verma, have talked about these new projects as game changers in healthcare. But what's the reaction been? And what is in these models? My Politico colleagues will discuss as part of a news roundup, where we also talk about changes to Obamacare and the fight over Medicare for all. And then we'll speak to today's guest, Dr. Asaf Bitton, who's an advisor to the CMS Innovation Center, but also was in the news this week because he's taking over Ariadne Labs, the Atul Gawande-founded think tank. And with that, let's get to the news roundup. Now joining me, two colleagues, Rachel Rubin, who covers healthcare providers for Politico. Welcome back to the podcast, Rachel.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
And Paul Demko, Pulse Check regular, who covers the insurance beat. Hello, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
We are going to talk about three topics, but where I wanted to start was the Innovation Center, Medicare's Innovation Center, and the payment pilots that it unveiled to change primary care this week. Now, I teased a bit about them in the podcast introduction. Secretary Azar has said this is a historic change. Andy Slavitt, the outspoken ex-Obama appointee, called it a, quote, watershed moment. Rachel, we broke this story over the weekend. You're our payment reform reporter. What are the two key pilots exactly, and how big a deal are they?
So the way to think about this really broadly is CMS is trying to get one out of four primary care providers to be in these pilots. And they're doing so by trying to capture like small independent practices that are normally not a part of these payment reform efforts, and by trying to capture like larger practices. So the first is called Primary Care First, and it pays practices a total monthly payment. And there's an option where they can get paid more for specializing and taking care of people who are chronically ill with serious conditions. And then there's one that's called direct contracting, which is for larger groups. It's kind of called the next generation, which was an ACO model that was an Obama era model. And it also does fixed monthly payments, and there's risk sharing involved, full or partial.
You just got into the pilots, but also use some jargon. I want to make sure listeners are following. So first, let's start with the primary care first model, the idea that physicians are going to get monthly payments up front, right? That's a big change.
And sort of the way CMS is describing that is that could free them up from having to worry about tracking their annual revenue cycle.
It'll make their jobs easier, theoretically.
That is the theory, yeah.
The number that you gave and that HHS has touted is that one quarter of the nation's doctors are getting shifted to this new model. But is that actually true? Like, are we seeing these changes happen overnight?
Yeah, no, they won't. They won't be imminent changes. The application will probably come out this summer. They're saying like a January 2020 start date. But sort of what's important with these models is it takes time to scale up. And, you know, you have to have a lot of providers and practices want to participate in that. And it is a voluntary model. So they're not mandating that providers do this.
I am old enough to remember when the Obama administration launched its accountable care organizations back in 2011. And that was the big experiment to get hospitals and doctors to team up and take on more risk in exchange for potentially getting paid more to care for patients. And one clear lesson is exactly that on the voluntary issue. Payment reform is hard. It's even harder when hospitals and doctors get to opt in and organizations fight to keep every dollar that they can, and they will threaten to quit these programs if they don't get changes made that maybe make it easier for them to keep their money, but the reforms don't kick in right away.
There were definitely questions on this at the press conference, and what Adam Bowler said, who is the head of the CMS Innovation Center, he was saying, particularly for the smaller one, that they're trying to make the model so simple that single practices can participate. But I mean, the other side is some stakeholders, a lot of people have praised it, but are saying, like, the devil is in the details. What exactly is this going to look like?
So we've heard a lot of positive reaction to the primary care pilot. The direct contracting pilot, a lot less attention. And I'm not exactly sure what that means, that the industry has been quieter. Can you explain how that does differ or maybe not differ from the Obama models that came before?
Yeah, it's supposed to build off of it. And that one is going to have a fixed monthly payment. There's going to be a full financial risk, and there's going to be some risk sharing. There's also one that they're calling geographic direct contracting that they're just really getting information on, but that could let a provider in like one area kind of take on the full cost of care, primary care patients. So I think people really have to dig into that and learn and finalize and see what all the details are going to be.
I mean, haven't we seen in the ACO, the next generation model, a pretty rapid decline in participation over time? I mean, I think just recently, the most recent numbers were 51 organizations down to 41. Why is this going to be any different than that in terms of participation?
Yeah. I think it might have been 58 to 41. But regardless, that's a really big question. And the administration is touting value-based care as one of their top priorities. But like, what exactly is their goal? How are all these models going to connect? They're going to be putting out more and more models. They keep on saying that. So sort of what is kind of the broad theme is, I think, a question that people have.
Right. There doesn't need to be every organization lining up to do this. There just need to be enough organizations. And we don't know right now how many organizations that have been on the sidelines are going to jump in when there had been decline in some of the participation before. I think it's interesting, too, the bipartisan support for these ideas. And Rachel, what is the industry saying in reaction to these pilots? Are physicians happy?
Yeah, I mean, the AMA afterwards had a statement that was supportive of this in terms of, they said the Innovation Center took doctors' ideas, and doctors want to have input when something is going to really affect them in their industry. So there is a lot of bipartisan support for this, which is interesting because the CMS Innovation Center was in Obamacare. That's what created it. And Republicans at first were worried that it had just too much power. But now there is support.
I think it's also telling that payment reform is the conversation that folks generally agree, right? Obama started this trend. Republicans got on board. Everyone loves the idea of paying less and getting more. And for HHS, for Alex Azar, this is a good conversation to have if he's on the Hill. He would rather talk payment reform than being grilled on how HHS is caring for migrant kids or changing abortion rules. And on the flip side, every time Democrats praise this HHS, praise Azar, every time Andy Slavitt puts out a tweet complimenting Alex Azar, that buys him more credibility when he wants to fire off the tweet attacking Medicaid work requirements.
But I have a question for both of you. I mean, you mentioned at the top, Alex Azar said, you know, this is a historic turning point in American healthcare. And I read that and I just found it kind of laughably over the top. But is that just my ignorance? How are you thinking about the significance of this moment?
I'll jump in as someone who used to cover hospitals at the advisory board and now works in this space at Politico. I think it could be historic, but you could say that about so many different pilots that happen. And as Rachel listed off, there are questions about who's going to participate. There are still questions about some of the details of these models. And we have seen declines over the past number of years. Is this the right step for the industry? Probably. But is it a lot of lip service for an idea that we have yet to see really transform the high cost of healthcare in America? I think so too.
Yeah, I do think it is a wait and see mode. And I think why people are interested in primary care is if you can do something that actually works, you have the potential to catch diseases quicker that could, if not caught, become more advanced and cost the health system more. And right now, the kind of larger focus has been on trying to clamp down on healthcare costs.
Let's move to our second topic. And yet again, is something that this administration has done using its regulatory power. Paul, CMS last week released its final rule for the 2020 annual notice of benefit and payment parameters. Or to put in simpler English, it announced its Obamacare marketplace changes. How did this administration just change the Obamacare market for next year?
Well, the biggest change is in the subsidies that are going to be available to people. And it's a pretty arcane change, which I won't get into. But the bottom line is it's going to be $980 million less in subsidies for people who qualify for financial assistance to purchase Obamacare plans, and a projected 70,000 fewer enrollees. So, you know, in the grand scope of things, those are big numbers, but to put it on a micro level, for an individual who makes $30,000, they'll be losing about $60 a month in subsidies, $60 a year, excuse me, so $5 a month roughly in subsidies. And for a family of four that makes about $60,000, they'll be losing about $120 a year in subsidies, so about $10 a month. And I should credit, those figures are from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And one other thing, there'll also be a slight increase in the out-of-pocket costs that people will be responsible for. So individuals will be on the hook for $200 more and families for $400 more. So the bottom line is folks are going to be getting a little less in subsidies and they're going to be paying a little more out of pocket.
Is that sabotage to the market?
Well, the Trump administration's justification for this, I think, was sort of twofold. One is that the formula that they had relied on in the past only took into account employer-based healthcare plans. And now they're adding in the individual market into that formula. And they're saying that that's a more reflective of the overall health insurance market. And, you know, it makes sense. In the early years, it made sense just to use the employer market because there was so much turbulence in the individual market with premiums jumping up and, you know, just no consistency there because of all the changes. So that's, and the second justification is they say, because the Trump administration eliminated cost-sharing reduction payments, that's led to a huge jump in subsidies. So this is just a minor sort of correction from that, if I can put it that way. Now, I think a lot of people are skeptical of that. I spoke to Matt Fiedler at the Brookings Institution about this yesterday, and he said, you know, really what you want is you want the most accurate measure of the change in healthcare costs. And you want the formula that's going to best reflect that. And he thinks that that still is really just looking at that employer market because of all the changes that we've seen in the individual market over the last 6 years.
The idea that this isn't sabotage, the Trump administration could have gone farther, right, in changing the market in ways that would have hurt Obamacare customers. The practice of silver loading, where regulators and insurers are trying to make it easier to insulate people from the costs. The Trump administration had said they might get rid of that practice, but they're letting it stand for now.
Yes, that and another one was whether they were going to continue to allow automatic re-enrollments. And I think insurers and consumer advocates were really worried that they might take steps to get rid of or scale back both of those. And in the initial proposal, they didn't propose that. They just asked for feedback on whether there should be changes to silver loading and automatic re-enrollments. And the interesting thing in the final proposal is that the feedback that they got was universal. Like, nobody said get rid of silver loading. Nobody said get rid of automatic re-enrollments. So you would think that that suggests that they won't go forward with that for 2021. But that's not necessarily so, because there was also universal opposition to the reduction in subsidies.
And I think it's interesting that while the industry and feedback might have been keep these things that essentially make Obamacare cheaper, the voices arguing to get rid of these things are people in the White House who are critics of Obamacare and want to see the rule unwound. The automatic re-enrollment, that is such a technical term, but it's hugely important, right? When you look at the numbers of people who are signing up or in some cases being opted in to sign up for Obamacare coverage, how many people?
I don't have the exact figure, but it's definitely millions of people that are automatically re-enrolled each year. And now that, especially now that the markets have kind of stabilized and premiums have kind of stabilized and competition is more stable than it's been, it makes a lot more sense that people might not necessarily need to change their plan. I think there was a huge emphasis in the early years from consumer advocates that you need to shop, you need to go back to the market and see what your options are. I'm sure they would give you that same message as well today, but it's not nearly as important now that things have kind of shaken out a little bit more in the markets and are more stable.
So in essence, do you think this silver loading, this automatic re-enrollment proposals, do you think you might see that in the next guidance next year?
I think there's absolutely a chance. I'd be more skeptical of the automatic re-enrollments being jettisoned, because if you think back to the end of open enrollment, Secretary Azar gave a speech, I can't remember the setting, where he sort of ridiculed the folks who had said, you know, oh, enrollment is down, you know, and pointed to the huge influx of automatic re-enrollments that happened at the end and brought the, you know, the total enrollment almost up to 2018 levels.
There was a real sense of the sky is falling, the Trump administration is sabotaging Obamacare. Look at how far enrollment is lagging. It's more than 10% off, 15% off. And I remember when Azar gave that speech and said, wait for these final re-enrollments to kind of kick in. HHS officials told me, they said, you know, the media was too hyperbolic here.
Yeah.
And should have been patient to see what happened at the end.
And I know from talking to somebody at CSIO about this, who was concerned about this practice being eliminated.
That CSIO, the insurance oversight part of HHS.
Thank you for explaining that. That, you know, that was greeted with kind of a sigh of relief, that Azar speech within the building, for folks who were concerned that they might try to get rid of that.
Well, because they'd also been cutting advertising funding and cutting funding for navigators, and their whole theory was this isn't going to change enrollment that much. So, I mean, if you don't have automatic re-enrollment, however many people aren't going to get on.
Yeah, I mean, who knows? We, you know, but it seems like, yeah, it could lead to a dramatic decrease in enrollment.
Paul, any last thoughts on this regulation?
Well, I should point out that the administration also reduced the health insurer fee by 0.5%, and that typically is just passed on to consumers in the form of lower premiums. So that should sort of mitigate some of the subsidy decreases, because consumers should have slightly lower premiums.
Let's move to our final topic, Medicare for All. You can't escape it in Democratic presidential town halls. The Trump administration keeps taking swipes at it. And the first ever congressional hearing on Medicare for All is looming next week. Clearly, this is an issue, but how important is it? Rachel, you're on the Hill. How much is Medicare for All being buzzed about?
I mean, I would point to the 2020 Democratic races as where the really big buzz is. And I mean, we saw Joe Biden jump in the race today, and we have a lot of Senate candidates who have to decide whether they are going to jump onto the Medicare for All bills or a Medicare X or Medicare buy-in. But we haven't heard Joe Biden talk about Medicare for All, and he's not in the Senate, so he doesn't have to decide whether to be a co-sponsor of one of these bills.
I thought what was interesting was Biden's entry into the race was framed around not his support for Medicare for All, but how this changes the window. Wall Street firms, and I think we were all looking at that Thursday morning when Biden jumped in, Wall Street firms said this is good for healthcare because insurance companies have been taking a beating ever since Bernie Sanders 2 weeks ago put out his Medicare for All plan. And while that plan is thought to be unlikely at best, that has caused some real skepticism. Biden's thoughts on health coverage are more in the vein of let's just expand what we currently have rather than scrap the whole system. And let me provide some data just around the Medicare for All debate. There was a Kaiser Family Foundation poll this week that found top priorities for respondents in healthcare. 68% of respondents said reducing drug costs should be a top priority. 64% said that keeping the ACA's pre-existing condition protections should be a top priority. Just 31% said that Medicare for All should be a top priority. And that basically squares with my read. It is in the mix, but it has fallen behind. Medicare for All has fallen behind on other issues that might be up front.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I mean, if you just ask people the question of whether they support Medicare for All, there's pretty broad support. But we've seen sort of the flip side of that is, you know, anytime you sort of dig into the nitty-gritty details and tell people well, it's going to cause taxes to go up, or it's going to cause people to no longer have their employer-based coverage, then you see those numbers drop dramatically. And so it's interesting, you know, slightly different lens, but that when you ask people what are their top priorities, that this does not register quite as high, which is going to be a challenge for those Democrats that are pushing this as their number one priority.
And there tends to be more broader support for ideas like a public option or a Medicare buy-in,
which are less transformative and more optional than remaking the entire healthcare
system.
Exactly.
They're sort of on the side.
But I think, you know, I got to highlight a story that our colleagues Rachna Pradhan and Dan Goldberg did a couple weeks ago now about how some of these, you know, less dramatic changes like a public option have really sputtered out in state capitals. And it just goes to show that even, you know, more minor changes to the healthcare system, how challenging and difficult that they become when you have to dig into the details and talk about how you're going to pay for it and all those other things that come with, you know, this incredibly complex, expensive system.
I think it was on the podcast last week we talked about that front page New York Times story on Neera Tanden and the Center for American Progress and the split in the Democratic Party over ideas like Medicare for All versus more centrist things like preserve the Affordable Care Act. And some of that is just based on experience. I have had Obama veterans bend my ear one after midnight after the health policy ball a couple months ago in a hotel ballroom saying, look, these young Democrats don't understand just how hard it was to get the Affordable Care Act through and the pain that our party suffered. As a result, they need to be really careful about Medicare for All. I love the idea, but the practicality is unlikely. And I think this hearing next week, this historic hearing in Congress on Medicare for All, it is instructive to know that this is the House Rules Committee. It is not the Energy and Commerce Committee. It is not the Ways and Means Committee, the prime time committees that actually move healthcare legislation. And the invitees who will be speaking are not the prime time heads of the American Hospital Association or American Medical Association or celebrity guests like Atul Gawande. It is, and with respect to the guests, these are not people who are going to move the dial. I have a feeling that this will be more of a footnote of a hearing than the start of the Medicare for All trend.
And I mean, you also have powerful industry players, doctors, hospitals, major insurance groups lining up against it. And you saw that with Obamacare repeal. It's the industry hates it, and that makes it hard.
I think the industry has a credibility problem, too, though. Like when all they do is just denigrate, you know, this as an idea and say, you know, we want to fix the current systems, but don't offer any actual solutions. Let's see what the AHA and AHIP can come together and AMA on an answer to surprise medical bills. And then I think they might have like more credibility in fighting this on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, you're right. There's so much finger pointing in over there.
United Health Group, the nation's leading insurer, has gotten lambasted because the CEO, Dave Wichmann, had said Medicare for All is a bad idea. Let's build on the current system. Let's get to universal coverage with the tools that they have. Paul, you had flagged this story for me. In the Minnesota press, they have been going after United Health Group saying, look, if you really care about building out the current system, why did you pull out of Obamacare largely? Why aren't you doing more to shore up the current markets that might be less profit-driven?
Yeah, I wonder if they might be having regrets about that. I mean, yeah, it was good. They goosed their stock price for a few quarters, through that decision. They were definitely losing money on those markets. But in the grand scheme of things, it was a tiny, tiny piece of their overall business. And you know, in terms of their standing on Capitol Hill, they might have been better off just, you know, gutting it out and taking a few losses in the short term and sticking with the marketplaces. But you know, that's their decision, obviously not mine.
A closing thought here, which is Medicare for All might not be a top priority for patients, but it is going to be a top political issue, I think, for the next year, because you've got Democratic candidates pushing these plans, and there will be some distinction between where does Bernie fall, where does Elizabeth Warren fall, and so on and so on. So that will spark debate in the primary. And then the Republicans, led by the Trump administration, want to attack on this issue. and will bring it up at every turn. There was a Medicare trustees report, which is the accounting of how much money is left in the Medicare fund. And the first time that I can remember, the Trump administration put out a report or put out a statement on this wonky report and used it as an opportunity to attack the idea of Medicare for all. So I think we will have to live with that argument for at least the next year, even if the law, even if this legislation doesn't really go anywhere.
Yeah, I mean, that's undoubtedly the turf they want to play on. Anytime you're on the offensive on healthcare, you're better off because defending the status quo is never, you know, a very popular thing because it's a screwed up, messed up system. Everybody agrees with that.
Well, I will let both of you get back to covering our screwed up, messed up system and refereeing those fights. Rachel Rubin, Paul Demko, thanks for joining the podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dan.
And now my conversation with Dr. Asaf Bitton. Dr. Asaf Bitton, welcome to Politico Pulse Check, and you're coming to us from Boston, the headquarters of Ariadne Labs. How are you?
Oh, I'm great. It's nice to be here with you.
You are doing something that I wouldn't wish on my worst enemy. You are the guy who has to follow Atul Gawande as head of Ariadne. Now, be honest, did you force Gawande out?
I can absolutely be honest and say he was not forced out. I guess it's my primary care background. We like to take on hard problems in primary care.
And Ariadne is famously Atul Gawande's creation. It's a think tank that he had launched, that you were an early employee of. I have to be honest, though, every time I've heard Ariadne mentioned, it's usually in a sentence about Atul Gawande. So can you describe exactly what the lab is focused on?
Absolutely. So we are a lab that is founded on the premise that health systems often fail to safely and reliably meet the needs of their patients. And they fail to do so because of a number of core reasons. They are either not designed with the needs of their users in mind, they're not designed to meet the complexity of healthcare systems, or they're designed to meet the needs and idiosyncrasies of financial payment models. And so what we do, what our mission is to reduce suffering by intervening with simple, scalable solutions at the most critical moments in people's lives. And what we've built is a lab with four main clinical program areas: the beginning of life, childbirth in both low-income countries and high-income countries, the end of life in terms of serious illness and end-of-life care, surgery, one of the most high-risk moments in a person's life, and primary care, that interstitial glue that connects it all together. And what we've done is build programs that design, test, and spread interventions that demonstrably reduce people suffering, reduce mortality, and work with partners all around the world and in the U.S. to do so.
Ariadne seems to me, both in what I know and what you've just said, as a place where the ideas in Gawande's New Yorker articles or books essentially got a real-world tryout. The end-of-life issues that you mentioned, Gawande wrote famously a book called Being Mortal. He wrote an article and then an entire book about the power of checklists. Ariadne has spent years testing whether checklists work in healthcare. Gawande wrote about the value of doctors having professional coaches. You are testing surgical coaches and so on. Is it wrong to characterize Ariadne as Gawande's personal think tank?
Well, it certainly started 6 years ago as a place to gather a set of people from diverse backgrounds to design and test these ideas. But I think that there's a real bidirectional relationship between the people that have come in, their ideas, their priorities, their experiences, the results of our tests, and what he's written about in this actually incredible sort of ecosystem of health system innovation, where we struggle and wrestle and test new ideas with partners everywhere. I mean, in fact, that's how I got started here. Atul and I have known each other for over a decade, and he first got to know me. He asked me to come to a lab meeting he was having in which he loved to host these debates, and the debate was, is there a checklist for primary care? And being the pugnacious primary care doc that I am, I happily took the no side of that argument. And there started a long discussion and relationship and struggle that, you know, he and I have had around primary care. And, you know, I think that not just myself, but many of the people who have come here, certainly the folks in serious illness care and others, I think Atul would say we've taught him and moved his thinking as much as he's made this his own personal lab.
Some of the ideas that you've looked into or that Gawande has written about, it seems like they've been harder to carry out in practice. The checklists that you mentioned, my understanding is that the checklists have not done as effective a job as reducing deaths among newborns as perhaps Dr. Gawande and others would have hoped. What do you think has been the signature finding from the work of the lab these past 6 years?
Yeah, it's a great question, Dan. We, you know, like any good, true, rigorous quality improvement group and group of implementers, you often find that things sometimes work and sometimes don't work. And the only failure is a failure to learn lessons from any test, whether it has a positive impact or not. Certainly the surgical work, which is spread around the globe, and actually last week, a really fascinating paper from Scotland showed a 37% reduction in Scottish-wide surgical mortality after implementation of the surgical-wide checklist. That has been a fantastic story. The work that you refer to in India in terms of the Better Birth trial, you know, didn't show similar results, but it went through a similar design process of building a checklist, what are the essential items, and then the difference in, I think, outcome is one really around one of the major insights that we're seeing, which is that it's not just enough to design, build, and test smart tools. You have to astutely understand the context in which those tools are implemented, the readiness of health systems and providers in those health systems to implement them, and then you can see whether the aggregate effects happen. In the India work, in many of these primary care clinics and birthing centers had so many challenges, so many lack of inputs, so many training deficits, so many needs and supports that weren't there, that a checklist by itself couldn't overcome. But that doesn't mean that you stop the work there. You really realign the work with other partners and see how can you build the right supports and target the right sites to hopefully get a better outcome next time.
Is there a new direction or a new initiative that you would like to take Ariadne toward under your leadership?
Well, I think that there are two new things that really build off of our older work. The first thing is that not just in the checklist work, but also in our primary care work and in our work on improving the experience of mothers and infants in delivery in the U.S., we're seeing that even before we design that penultimate tool that end user tool, understanding and creating maps and understanding the gaps in which our systems are dysfunctioning or not meeting the needs of patients, both across health systems and also across geographies. Like, for instance, in primary care, we've been working with the World Health Organization, the Gates Foundation, and the World Bank to make visible what has heretofore been invisible in terms of the state of primary care at a regional and national level for large countries in the low and middle income world. That information you would assume is there, but it actually has taken a number of years and a parsimonious mechanism to come together and say, here on one page, policymaker or stakeholder, is the condition of your system. And here are the gaps that we see in your system. Where would you like to next intervene? The Delivery Decisions Initiative, the one that works in the U.S. around improving childbirth in the U.S., is starting similar work around understanding the condition of maternal mortality at the county and large metropolitan area in the U.S., and understanding the gaps and causes of the differences in this mortality. That buildup, that gap map, is the start of where you can have a better conversation on targeting future initiatives. So I think intervening at these critical system moments and understanding the system performance and the variations is a big direction for us. And then I think, unsurprisingly, given my background, we like so many others, are understanding the importance of primary care as a bedrock to high-performing health systems, both in the U.S. and abroad. And I think we're going to be continuing and expanding our work in that area as well.
I want to get to your background in primary care, but first, just a logistical question. The founder of Ariadne is moving on. I think this would be a question anytime the founder of an organization departs. Where is the funding situation for Ariadne? My understanding is you've grown to over 100 staff, you're Harvard affiliated. Is there a commitment to keep Ariadne Labs open for a certain amount of time and a certain amount of funding?
Absolutely, yeah. We have a strong funding base. Our funding base is based both on grants and contracts from funders and partners around the world, as well as a strong philanthropic funding base. And if anything, the reaction last year to Atul's departure on the philanthropic end was a doubling down or an increase by some of our core funders in believing in what we're doing. Because I think, to your earlier questions, Dan, I think there's a recognition amongst our key partners and key stakeholders that Ariadne Labs has actually grown into more than being Atul Gawande's lab. It's a set of programs that are each doing really path-breaking work, important work, and you know, while having Atul on board was an amazing experience and amazing gift for the lab more than can stand on its own two feet. And he will continue on as chairman of our board and providing input and good counsel. But I think that we're excited about our future and excited about our partnerships.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about your path. And this is one reason I was so keen to talk to you for the podcast this week, Doctor. You have been an advisor to the CMS Innovation Center since 2012. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
And the Innovation Center this week put out new primary care pilots that you helped advise on. Now, my colleagues and I talked a bit about what is in those pilots, but I'm curious, from your perspective as an advisor, how did these pilots come to be, especially because there have been pilots in the past that the Obama administration rolled out that these are now building on or replacing?
Yeah. Well, yes. So first, yes, I've been a senior advisor since 2012. And though I don't speak in an official capacity for CMS, I have been quite involved in the creation of this work. And I think that the way to look at it is that CMMI and CMS in general plays a really important role in trying to help move the needle toward a direction that better sustains and pays for primary care. And the reason is that I think it's widely acknowledged that we have basically a delivery system now that's generally built upon and meant to serve the needs of a financial model, as opposed to financial models that are built to serve the needs of the delivery systems that we want to have. And so in these pilots, starting in 2012 with the Comprehensive Primary Care pilot and moving into Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, and now with these new ones, we see an important set of items here. Number one, we see a focus and an important signal from CMS that working in aligned, multi-payer, regional point of view can actually help practices build the capacity from multiple angles of their payment streams to do great work. The second is that what bedeviled a lot of the early primary care transformation work with medical homes, et cetera, was that the standards and other mechanisms for seeing if practices were actually transforming were getting too long. They were like 104 item checklists, and that's just too much for any practicing clinic to target. And what we've done with comprehensive primary care and with these new ones is to really rationalize that and really get it down to making a big bet on a few large areas like care management, integrated behavioral health, social needs assessment, et cetera, that we think If primary care practices focus on, they'll get the results that they want and that stakeholders across the country want.
There's been a lot of positive reaction to the announcement this week, reaction across the aisle, and folks like Dr. Gawande, your colleague that we've now talked about extensively, he has been on Twitter praising this Akshay Shah for these new pilots. I'm curious, Doctor, how special, how unique is this effort? Is this simply something that any administration would have done to build on the work that was already out there? Or is the Trump administration actually doing something transformative and different?
I think that we're really seeing that primary care is one of the few items in healthcare where there is broad and deep bipartisan support. And there has been consistent, though perhaps not enough, bipartisan support through the years. Because I think that, number one, policymakers know that their constituencies want long-term relationships with effective primary care providers and teams to carry with them over the journey of healthcare and their health needs over a lifetime. I think number two, there's no longer a debate that there are many things that primary care is struggling with, especially in the finances. And number three, there's, I think, consensus that this has been an evolution over a spectrum. And we started by paying a little bit extra with these care management fees per month on a chassis of fee-for-service. And we got some results that were promising but not game-changing. And then we were seeing in CPC Plus starting to pay fundamentally differently, especially with Track 2, in which we finally have a capitated payment for part of a primary care practice's book of business over the year. And then you evolve in primary care first to an underlying risk-adjusted population-based payment for services in the practice, as well as a performance basis. And then on the side, a little bit of a visit fee just to sort of mitigate the known consequences of being capitated. So, you know, when I came into CMMI, a lot of the discussion was, well, you know, CMS has never paid a capitation rate for primary care, so that's not going to be possible to do. And I think one of the benefits that administrations across the political spectrum see with CMMI is that you can test in a rigorous manner important new ways of paying for different types of delivery. And if they prove to be successful, you can scale them.
You are an expert in behavioral health. I just saw a survey from Gallup that Americans are among the most stressed individuals in the world. There have been other data points and surveys that suggest mental health is at a bad point across the nation. Drug overdoses are historically high. What is the status of mental health in America, and is it trending the right direction?
The status is not great, and it's not trending in the right direction. And there are a lot of reasons. You've just enumerated many of them on the societal level. From a provider level, we don't have enough behavioral health providers, specialists to treat and meet the needs that we have. But we also, I think, are at a pivot point in terms of the ways that we think about behavioral health. We've for too long siloed it. We've carved it out financially. We've siloed it and made it a specialty referral. And I think that the most exciting models, and certainly we've made a big bet on them with the CMMI pilots, but many, many others are seeing that the ways to improve the health of populations are to integrate behavioral health into the primary care practice, either with co-located social workers and behavioral health specialists, or even with telephonic or kind of at distance resources, especially for those of us who practice in rural areas. And by doing so, we're seeing great outcomes, and we're seeing outcomes improve not just in behavioral health, but also in the health of chronic diseases and other areas. So I think that this is a real growth area. And this is actually one of the reasons why people who have access to primary care do better, because primary care isn't just about coughs, colds, and hypertension management. It's about care of the whole patient, which includes mind and body.
Last question. I was telling an HHS official I was going to jump on this interview with you today, and this person said, wow, I'm so interested in Ariadne. I've heard such good things about this think tank. I wonder what it would be like to work there. So now that you are running this think tank, this well-thought-of think tank, I'm curious, what sorts of people would you be looking to hire?
We look to hire people who have a passion for making an impact on the health of populations locally and globally. We love creative people, people who work well in teams, who are risk takers, and who love to laugh and work hard, but also have a great time working for great causes. So if you know anyone, please let us know or go to our website.
Well, Dr. Bitton, we are so glad that you took some time out from your new gig running Ariadne Labs, and thank you for joining the podcast.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. My thanks to colleagues Rachel Rubine and Paul Demko for joining to discuss the news, Dr. Asaf Bitton for joining to discuss his work at Ariadne Labs, and producer Carol Zoll in Boston and Dave Shaw in D.C. for producing the show. A quick reminder that if you like Pulse Check, you can help us. Just search for Politico Pulse Check on your favorite podcast app and leave a rating or a review. You can find me with suggestions or reactions by email at ddiamond@politico.com. And you can find a new episode of Pulse Check in your podcast player next week.